We're continuing our series going through John's account of Jesus' life and death and resurrection. And we've got to chapter 12, verse 27, just at the bottom of the left-hand column there. Chapter 12, verse 27, page 899. Jesus said, "Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this very purpose I've come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice came for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, "We've heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" So Jesus said to them, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness doesn't know where he's going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light." Well, please keep that passage open in front of you, and you'll see a little outline on the inside of the folded sheet, just showing you where we're going. And I want to begin with a question, and you don't have to answer it, or you can answer it in your head, but it's a rhetorical question. What is your proudest achievement? Or to put it in biblical language, what is it that you glory in? Same thing. What are you most proud of? What do you most boast about? Not necessarily overtly, but you can always tell, can't you, what somebody's proud of, because quite early on in a conversation where they meet a new person, they'll accidentally let it be known that such and such. You know, did I mention I have 12 children? Or did I mention I got a top first at university? Or did I mention I'm a famous French horn player? Or, you know, whatever it is. Often, our proudest achievements come through on our Facebook feeds. One of my friends pointed out the fact that on Facebook, everyone that I know looks amazing. Because you always select, don't you, the picture in which you look rather flattering, or all the things that were successful. And you pretty much censor the things that didn't go well, unless they didn't go well in a comedy kind of way. So I think I posted on Facebook once the time that I used my blender without realizing it was quite important to put the lid on first. And there was a sort of vortex of banana sprayed all over the kitchen. And it was a kind of funny photo. So I'll let you see that kind of failure, but certainly not the kind that makes me look genuinely bad. What do you boast in? What are you most proud of? Where is your glory? That's a question for everybody. Now a question for members of the church here. If you're a member of Grace Church Greenwich, what makes you proudest about our church or about being a Christian? And you can tell, because when you get into a conversation about being a Christian or about church, this will be the thing that you mention most quickly, that you want to make sure that everybody knows. I actually had a live test of this question just 2 days ago. I was down in Devon for a conference of Christian ministers. And on the train, I met some very friendly people. In fact, both directions, very friendly people. And we got into the conversation of, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a pastor of a church. And, oh, what's your church like? And I can tell you the sort of things I was proud about. So there's lots of us. We're growing. I made sure I mentioned that. You know, we were 50 3 years ago. Now we're a bigger crowd than that, about 100 or so of us on a Sunday. Or I mentioned that we're having a baby boom. In fact, Kate Squire suggested that somebody, and this is a request, somebody should write an article for the local paper, because our baby boom is statistically so abnormal. Apparently, the incidence of twins in the normal population is something like 1 in 50 pregnancies. And in Grace Church, in the last year or two, in 8 pregnancies, 3 of them have been or will be twins. which is growing our creche at a very accelerated rate. I like to mention the fact that there's all sorts of us. We've got people from every decade, I say, with all sorts of backgrounds. People say, is it a student church? And I'm kind of proud to say yes, as in people are surprised that there are young people interested in God. But I'm also proud to say no. We're not mainly students, we're all sorts of people. We're a whole mixture. But I just noticed I find it easy to talk about church and we're successful and there's lots of us and we're growing and we've got lots of children. And I don't immediately talk about the fact that we worship somebody who was executed on a cross. It doesn't come instantly to my mind. Maybe I assume that everybody knows that. I mean, it's kind of commonplace, isn't it, that Jesus was crucified on Good Friday, so I don't bother to say. Or maybe it just isn't the thing about being a Christian that I'm most proud of or that I most glory in. But in this passage, Jesus says that the hour that he dies will be the hour of his greatest glory. And the Father, God the Father, he agrees. Verse 27, Jesus says, now is my soul troubled. In other words, this isn't just some sort of cheap glory, an easy victory. This is something that terrifies Jesus. He's just going to be, the next couple of chapters, betrayed. The soldiers will turn up to arrest him. He'll be dragged off to a false trial. He'll be beaten and mocked and nailed to a cross. And he will die. And he doesn't find that an easy prospect. Some of us last weekend were away for the Grace Church, Greenwich Church weekend. We were thinking about the amazing miracle, the wonder that Jesus was both God and an ordinary human being. And so as a real human being, the thought of an execution was not an easy one to contemplate. He says, now is my soul troubled. Understatement. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. That wouldn't be an unbelieving thing to say. In fact, you can find Psalms, the songbook of the Old Testament, again and again in Psalms of distress, people cry out to God saying, God, save me, deliver me. My soul is troubled, deliver me. So Jesus could have gone with the script. It's a normal thing for a Christian to do in a time of crisis, to call out to our Heavenly Father, help me, save me. But Jesus decides not to pray that. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, for this very purpose I've come to this hour of my impending crucifixion. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it. Again. In other words, you'll see our first point on the sheet. In other words, God the Father is most glorified by the death of his Son. If you could get an exclusive interview with God and you asked him, God, what are you most proud of? There's quite a lot of candidates, aren't there? I mean, God's done quite a lot of pretty amazing things. So you might think he would point to an episode of Planet Earth or Blue Planet or Planet Earth 2 or Blue Planet 2 and say, look at this, pretty cool, isn't it? You have to go, that's pretty cool, God. You're right to be proud about that. But God the Father says that he is most glorified in his Son being executed in a barbaric way on a Roman cross. What on earth is going on? In fact, the plot thickens, as they say, because according to this passage, Jesus' crucifixion, his execution, is even more glorious than what happened on Mount Sinai. We saw the kids talk, the mountain and the cave, and how Moses, having asked to see God's glory, was hidden in the cave while God's glory passed by. And on that mountain, previously there had been thunder and lightning and thick darkness and a loud trumpet blast and an earthquake and very wonderful and terrifying things. But John's gospel says, you know, really that's nothing compared with what we've seen as we've hung out with this fisherman for 3 years. The law came through Moses, he says in chapter 1. That's a pretty amazing thing, the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. The law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, and we have seen his glory. John, as somebody who was there at the crucifixion, says, I saw a glimpse of God's glory that trumped even what Moses heard. Moses was told he couldn't see, but we saw, says John. We saw Jesus nailed to the cross. Even more glorious than Mount Sinai. Even more glorious than Jesus' miracles. So God the Father answers Jesus, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. When he says, I have glorified it, he's talking about some incidents already in Jesus' ministry that are really quite amazing. So in chapter 2 of John's Gospel, you don't need to turn to it now, but Jesus goes to a wedding, and the wedding's going badly because the reception wasn't planned properly, and they run out of booze quite early on. And Jesus' mum gets him involved, and he says, my hour hasn't yet come. In other words, it's not really the time for me to show my glory, but nonetheless, Jesus turns gallons of water into the best kind of wine. And we're told, chapter 2, verse 11, thus he showed his glory. I love telling that story because it's such a surprise to 21st century people who got the idea that God is a killjoy and a spoil sport, whose greatest fear is that somebody somewhere in the world might be having fun. And as my friend put it, we have an idea of a God who, if he had the chance, would turn wine into water. And I love to point out that Jesus was the man who made the party go with a swing. Jesus loves weddings and all they stand for, and he wanted to help the celebration. And he showed, in a small way, in a miraculous way, he showed his glory. Chapter 2. But then, at a rather more serious celebration, well, not really a celebration, but a wedding, and then a funeral. Chapter 11. A man called Lazarus, who was a close friend of Jesus. And we looked at it just a few weeks ago, those of us who are regulars at Grace Church. And Jesus says to the disciples, this death of Lazarus was for God's glory, so that God's son might be glorified through it. And then when he turns up at the funeral and he sees Mary and Martha, the sisters of the dead man, weeping, Jesus himself is overcome with emotion, but he says to them, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And then he calls to the dead man, Lazarus, come out. And amazingly, this guy, who was dead now for 4 days, walks out of the tomb in front of eyewitnesses. In fact, it's one of the things that really makes Jesus incredibly popular in the first century, because people have heard about this, and the news spreads everywhere, and people think this guy can get people back from the dead. And no wonder he was a superstar. I have glorified it, says the Father, but I will glorify it again. And this glorification is the ultimate one. At the wedding, Jesus says, my hour has not yet come. At Lazarus's funeral, Jesus says there's a few hours left of daylight. But now, as he's about to be arrested, tried, executed, he says, the hour has come. Glorify your name. It doesn't really make sense, does it, on first hearing? Somebody who can turn water into wine, I would celebrate. In fact, most of us would celebrate, right? That's pretty amazing. Somebody who can bring dead people back from the dead, that's even more amazing. But somebody who can get himself killed, it's not so impressive, is it? What is it about Jesus' execution that makes it so amazing, so wonderful, that God the Father is so proud of it? Well, I've put point number two, that this is a upside down, back to front kind of death. Because everything about it is the opposite of what you might think. There's actually a clue, just even in the language Jesus uses. He talks about being lifted up. And it's a kind of deliberate pun, because to be lifted up means to be exalted or to be praised. A few weeks ago, we looked at one of these verses in John's Gospel about being lifted up. Andrew was teaching the children, and he showed on the screen the podiums that you get in the Olympics. And you get the bronze medal and the silver medal, and the gold medal is the highest one. And then I think we had the Formula One. The Formula One podium, even higher. So it's built above the whole track, really, really high. And the guy who comes first gets to stand on the podium, lifted up. It means glorified. I'm proud of this guy. We're celebrating this guy. We've lifted him up. So it means that on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's a kind of grim double meaning, because Jesus means being lifted up, as in being nailed up, as the cross is lifted up and dropped into the hole in the ground and he slowly suffocates. The same pun actually Jesus gets from the prophet Isaiah. See, my son will be lifted up and exalted, he says. And goes on to say that he would be pierced and crushed and wounded. The same paradox actually that he got from Moses, that verse we said together, as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man will be lifted up. It refers to a time in Israel's history when God's people were under a curse because of the evil that they'd done, and they were being bitten by snakes, and the solution was to take the curse, the snake, and to lift it up. So the curse was on a pole. And Jesus draws on all of that Old Testament imagery from the law of Moses, from the prophet Isaiah. And he makes this double meaning. I will be lifted up. Both the moment that I am cursed, the moment that I am crushed and pierced and bruised, and yet the moment that I am most exalted and glorified. Why? Well, because everything at the cross is upside down and back to front. Just look down at verse 31. Or look up at verse 31, top of the right-hand column. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. Just seems to me that every one of these phrases is a surprise. Now is the judgment of this world, or the condemnation of this world. That's a surprise, isn't it? Because the cross looks like it's the condemnation of Jesus by the world. The Jewish council try him. The Roman governor sentences him. And they condemn him. You must die by crucifixion. And all the crowd join in with their voices raised. Crucify him, crucify him. You might think that it was the judgment of Jesus. And Jesus notes the other way around. This is the moment of judgment on the world. This is the moment that God announces his condemnation on a human race that, given the chance, choose to execute their maker. We live in a society, don't we, that's very optimistic about human progress and human goodness, despite very, very much evidence to the contrary. More knife crime and teenagers killing teenagers in this city almost every day in the papers. More mass shootings in America. It's not even news now, is it, for somebody to go into a school and open fire on children? It's just another mass shooting. More child abuse, more children taken away from their parents into care, more people living alone, more family breakdown. And yet we manage to be very positive about ourselves. We're getting better and better and better. And Jesus says, no. Here's the sentence. When your maker visited the earth, you killed him. Now it's the judgment on the world, says Jesus. Now, he says, will the ruler of this world be cast out? The ruler of the world is Jesus' title for the devil. It's not immediately obvious, but you see how he uses the phrase later. It means Satan, the ruler of this world. God is the ruler of the whole universe, but Satan has the dominion of this world. And you might think, in fact, John himself says that the cross is the moment that Satan enters in. Satan comes and takes control of Judas Iscariot, one of Jesus' closest friends, and spurs him on to betray Jesus. And maybe we're tempted to think of the cross as the victory for the dark side. And then Jesus gets to fight back on Easter morning when he bursts through death. But Jesus doesn't agree. He says, now the cross, this is not the devil's victory, this is the devil's defeat. Now the prince of this world is, the ruler of this world is cast out. It's a major own goal for Satan as he finds his kingdom destroyed. Because at the cross, Jesus takes the punishment that our sin deserves if we trust in him, so that we can be forgiven, so that we can be released from the devil's grip, so that we can come to be reconciled to a heavenly Father. And then finally, verse 32, I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. You might think that the message of an executed Messiah would repel people. Doesn't look like he's won. Doesn't look like he's powerful. Doesn't look like he's victorious. And indeed, the cross has been, and still is, I guess, a stumbling block to some people. So it is a stumbling block to Jews in the early centuries. They thought the Messiah ought to come in victory and Jesus came in defeat. That was the problem. It was a stumbling block to some Greeks. They were looking for a powerful message, a bit like the philosophy of Nietzsche in the 20th century. They looked for strength and power, and again, here was weakness. So the cross has been a stumbling block to some, but over 2,000 years, it has been the thing that has drawn millions to trust him. He was right. When I'm lifted up, I'll draw all people. You see, everything is back to front. It looks like a defeat, but it's a victory. It looks like the world judges Jesus, but he judges the world. It looks like the devil got 1-0, but actually it was the moment that the devil lost. It looks like it might drive us away, but actually it draws us to him. You see, the moment of Jesus' death was the moment of his glory, the moment of our salvation if we trust in him, the moment of which God the Father is most proud. I looked at Clinton's cards online, trying to find out the way in which we celebrate things. And actually, and I was trying to find something I could put on the screen, but there was nothing even that interesting. Mostly they were just balloons going off and party poppers and people saying, well done. You know, well done on your driving test, well done on your exams. Congratulations on your engagement to those two up there. There's news to ask them about after us at coffee time. Lots of kind of well done cards, congratulations cards. But this is the moment that we might want to send a card to God to celebrate. Well done. You must be very proud of your son on the day of his greatest achievement, his execution. But then finally, the clock is ticking. We need to respond to Jesus' death. Initially, the response of the crowd is not very encouraging. In fact, they start quibbling. If you've been following the narrative for the last few chapters, you know this is entirely in their character. Always grumbling, always complaining. And they say, verse 34, we've heard from the law, we've been reading our Old Testament, that the Christ is supposed to live forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? You know, it doesn't make sense. If the Messiah is going to be eternal, how can the Messiah die? Well, Jesus could answer their conundrum by saying, well, because 3 days after I die, I'm going to live again, and then I'll live forever. That would be the obvious answer. Instead, Jesus gives them a warning. He says, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who's walking in the darkness doesn't know where he's going. While you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of light. It's a little warning. He says, you've got a chance now. Make sure you make the most of your chance before it gets dark. I explained a few weeks ago that darkness in the Bible is a very, very dangerous thing. We don't really get the sense of it because we have electric lights and torches and we live on in a city with pavements. But if you can imagine, you lived in a country with ravines and cliffs and precipices, and you didn't have torches or electric lights, then darkness is very, very dangerous. In the dark, you trip and you fall and you die. But in the light, you see your path clearly and you walk successfully to your destination. So Jesus is giving a sort of light darkness warning, but he says, look, the time is limited. The light's among you just for a little while longer. I spent quite a lot of this last week trying to puzzle out what is the time scale that Jesus is talking about. And I think for his first hearers, he is literally talking about just a matter of a couple of days. As in, very soon, Judas is going to slip out to betray me. And John says in the narrative, as Judas disappears from the group, it was night. I think night physically, but also night metaphorically. The light's going out, and then the soldiers arrive, and then the trial, and then... I think he means that there is literally just a matter of a few hours left before I get executed. So make sure that you respond now. It's like Judas, he gets stuck the wrong side of Jesus' death. He doesn't respond to the light while he has it. And night falls, and he is lost. So there's this clock ticking down to Good Friday as Jesus is executed. But then I thought, okay, well, I get that for the first hearers, but what about for us? Because when John is writing this, it's actually after Good Friday. I mean, he's writing about a conversation that happened before Good Friday, but he's putting pen to paper after Good Friday and after Easter Sunday. So he wants the reader to also think about the time scale. He wants us also to think there's only a limited amount of time left of the light before the darkness comes. And it's as if what Jesus says to Judas and the others, he also says to all of us, make sure you respond to the light while you have the chance. Because soon, in a little while, the darkness is coming. And the one who walks in darkness doesn't know where he's going and faces all sorts of danger and destruction. So while you have the light, walk in the light. Can I just make a personal plea, quite frankly, to all of us? This isn't the kind of message that you hear in London every day. It's quite an extraordinary message, isn't it? You don't hear it on the BBC. Today, celebration, the greatest ever thing that happened in the world, Jesus' crucifixion. I mean, it's not in the papers, it's not in the world outside. You've heard a message that you don't always hear today. And according to Jesus, and according to his Father, the most important message in the world. And it would be so easy, wouldn't it, just to shelve it. Or ignore it, or forget it, or move on, and life is going to be busy because it's almost Christmas, and then that's it forgotten. And Jesus says, you've heard something very, very important, so take account of it, and take advantage of the light while you have the light. Respond. The clock's ticking. We need to respond to Jesus' death. Here's some questions to talk about over coffee at the bottom of the sheet. What are you most proud of? Maybe you could admit what's on your Facebook feed this week. But how proud are you of Jesus' death on the cross?